Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up on today's program, the 23rd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown by the Chinese government has just passed. People in Hong Kong were able to hold a memorial where more than 100,000 attended. China, on the other hand, is very different. We'll have two reports from Beijing and Hong Kong. North Korea has threatened to strike against media outlets in South Korea over the coverage of a youth festival that was held in Pyongyang. Some are saying the North is using this rhetoric to boost its new leader, Kim Jong-un, but the South is not taking any chances. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. June 4th marks 23 years since the Chinese government launched a violent military crackdown on the country's pro-democracy movement. And, as it has done every anniversary, the government sought to silence anyone attempting to honor the hundreds of people who died. We have this report from Katie Hammond.
If you tried to search for the numbers 6, 4 and 23, or the words candle and never forget in a Chinese web browser today, the internet would have failed you. These were the characters that censors blocked for the 23rd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown, in which hundreds, possibly thousands of protesters died. Social media users expressed outrage at the censorship, and some did succeed in posting pictures of the massacre. But with the difficult leadership change ahead this year, the Chinese government appears to be stepping up efforts to silence its critics. Dr. Anne Kent is a visiting fellow at the Australian National University's School of Law and an expert on human rights in China. She says whilst in some ways there is more freedom of expression in China, 23 years on from Tiananmen, the situation for political dissidents has not improved.
Things have got almost worse for a number of reasons, and that's because, of course, the Jasmine Revolution, which alarmed the Chinese leaders. It's also because of leadership instability, and it's because of social instability within China.
China's human rights record has been in the spotlight recently after blind dissident Chen Guangcheng made a dramatic escape from house arrest in Shandong province to the US Embassy in Beijing. Mr. Chen was imprisoned for exposing the practice of forced abortions and sterilizations in rural China. He claims that he and his family were repeatedly harassed and physically abused by local security forces. Professor David Goodman is the academic director of the University of Sydney's China Studies Centre. He says the Chen Guangcheng affair shows the challenges the central government has in controlling human rights beyond Beijing.
I think you have to ask who controls the mechanisms of human rights that you're talking about. That's to say the security forces and stopping people having free expression and doing the things they want to do. And that, of course, comes back to a problem that the system has, which is that although it's a Communist Party state, the level of control exercised out of Beijing is very variable. And things can happen because Beijing cannot control or chooses not to control either people within its own system in Beijing, within specific parts of that system, or out in the provinces. And the recent problems that the blind lawyer who fled to the United States had were caught up in that kind of situation where local politicians had acted one way. Central government felt they had to support those local officials, but there were enough people at the centre who were appalled at the way that he was being handled locally to make it kind of a standoff, a situation where nobody could do anything to help anybody else.
Whilst the Chen Guangcheng affair has caused embarrassment for the Chinese government, recent political ructions, which saw the ousting of one of the party's rising political stars, Bo Zhili, are proving a much greater distraction. And Professor Goodman says reforms of any kind are not on their agenda.
When those who are in power decide that political reform is seriously on the agenda, those kinds of issues will be seriously on the agenda. At the moment, they are not on the agenda because political reform is not seriously on the agenda. There has been a lot of change since way back in the 1970s. But the next stages towards some kind of rule of law, towards some check on the untrammeled power of the state, some notion that you must replace certainty by uncertainty as a principle of politics, those are a long way away.
Meanwhile, the memory of the events of June the 4th, 1989, and the government's silence on the matter finally proved too much to bear for one grieving parent. On Friday, 73-year-old Yahweh Lin hung himself in a disused car park in Beijing. Mr. Ya's 22-year-old son, Aigu, was shot in the head and killed by Chinese soldiers during the crackdown. Together with a group called Tiananmen Mothers, Mr. Ya campaigned for years for the government to revise its verdict that the incident was the result of a counter-revolutionary rebellion and to open an independent investigation into the killings. Dr. Anne Kent says Mr. Ya's death is a sign that many in China are despairing of the human rights situation in their country.
His is the best sign that many people in China are losing hope of any change in the verdict on that massacre.
For most people in China, the anniversary of the bloody events in Tiananmen Square 23 years ago went unnoticed. Well, that's at least publicly. Government suppression and its sophisticated internet censoring system is blocking key phrases like Tiananmen Massacre or Remember June 4th. Chinese state media is also banned from anything referring to incidents around Tiananmen Square in 1989. While barely a word is mentioned of the events on the Chinese mainland, in Hong Kong it's a different story. Monday night, more than 100,000 people gathered to mark the anniversary. Here's Stephen McDonald.
On the Chinese mainland, it's as if the events of June 1989 never happened. The People's Liberation Army drove tanks into the heart of Beijing and soldiers fired on unarmed protesters, killing an unknown number of people in and around Tiananmen Square. China's state-controlled media virtually never mentions the bloody end to months of student unrest 2 decades ago. And in the Chinese capital, this anniversary passes pretty much like any other day. But here in Hong Kong, it's different. I'm standing in Victoria Park amongst what must be 100,000 demonstrators, many wearing T-shirts or stickers, pledging to never forget the 4th of June 1989.
We have to let everyone know about the true history of these events, says one young woman who wasn't even born when they took place. She goes on, we have to be persistent in letting Chinese people and Hong Kong people know what really happened, what the hidden truth is. I want democracy, I want human rights, says another woman. I came because my heart was moved, says yet another.
Do you think you can change anything by coming here today?
Maybe not today, but I think in the future, all Chinese can show to our government, the Chinese government will feel in their heart.
Feel in their heart what really happened?
Yes.
The park became a sea of candles. There were solemn moments as the names of parents who lost their children were read out. Flowers were offered for those who died in 1989, and this massive gathering bowed in unison as a mark of respect. Even the organisers of the rally didn't expect such an enormous response. It could be because the Chinese authorities have been coming down harder on dissent of late. Of high-profile cases like blind activist Chen Guangcheng or jailed Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo, or simply because people don't want these momentous events to go unremembered. The government in Beijing may have been hoping that these anniversaries would fade with time. But instead, they seem to be getting even bigger.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. The United States and the European Union have urged North Korea to resume nuclear talks with the international community, stalled since April when Pyongyang conducted a failed rocket launch. The move comes as speculation mounts that North Korea is preparing to conduct a third nuclear weapons test. It also comes at a time of increased tension with the South. North Korea's military is threatening to launch a missile strike against major media outlets in Seoul in response to critical coverage in the South of a mass children's rally in Pyongyang. Mark Willacy in Seoul has the story.
The North Korean TV news story shows thousands of children surging across the square towards the bronze statues of Kim Il-sung and his son Kim Jong-il. Wearing identical uniforms of blue and white with red scarves, these 20,000 kids were brought to Pyongyang to mark the 66th anniversary of the Korean Children's Union and to pledge their loyalty to the new leader Kim Jong-un. I made up my mind to study even harder as I presented the bouquet to the beloved Great Marshal Kim Il-sung and Great Marshal Kim Jong-il, says this third grade student. This will make teacher Kim Jong-un happy, she says. This display of obedience and enforced affection prompted critical coverage in South Korea, one broadcaster likening the event to a Hitler youth rally from Nazi-era Germany. That sparked near apoplexy in Pyongyang. It is the iron will of our army that these dens of heinous provocateurs, fools and blockheads who are hurting the dignity of our supreme leadership should not be allowed to exist, says the newsreader on North Korean state TV. It's the usual spray of colourful invective from the North, but then came a most specific and unprecedented warning, with the country's military central command threatening to launch missile strikes against the South's media. It said its soldiers had entered the latitude and longitude coordinates of the media's headquarters in Seoul in preparation for a possible attack. We would like to ask the South if they want to let these strikes happen, says the North Korean newsreader. Or do they want to apologize and put the situation under control? They have the final choice, she warns. The new regime in Pyongyang has ratcheted up the hostility and threats against the South in recent weeks, a move analysts say is designed to bolster the leadership of the young Kim Jong-un. But Seoul says these latest threats against its media are way out of line. The North's specific threat against our media is a grave provocation against a liberal democracy, says South Korean Unification Ministry spokesman Kim Hyung-suk. It's intolerable, and we're taking this very seriously, he says. Seriously enough that police have been deployed to guard some media offices in Seoul. A sign, perhaps, that the South doesn't fear so much the North's missiles as its ability to launch an act of terror.
Now we cut to Cambodia. The ruling Cambodian People's Party, or CPP, has once again dominated the country's commune elections, with early results showing it has won 97% of the commune chief positions. There are 1,633 communes in Cambodia, and the control at this level gives leaders a great deal of localized influence over citizens and state money, something important for next year's national elections. Liam Cochran speaks next to the executive director of the Committee for Free and Fair Elections, Kyol Panha.
We heard that, as you said, the CPP is lead the result, and opposition, Samaksi Party also lost, and the Human Rights Party also gained some seat in Commune Council, but the main loss is Norodom Rajat Party and the Phongsupek Party. They also lost.
And the early results that that we're seeing is that the Funcinpec Party and the Norodom Ranarit Party got some commune councillor seats, but no commune chief positions, so they don't control any of the communes. For the CPP, how many commune chief positions did they win?
Officially, we not get the official results. We found out that the CPP gained from the around 60.8% of the votes. Now, the in this commune council in 2013, they gained more around 61.7% of the vote. That means during 2007, the second commune council election, they got only 60.8% of the vote, but now it's 61.7 of the vote. So they can vote, but however the official commune councillor calculation is not yet done by the National Election Commission.
Okay, sure.
But however, we can estimate that the CPP able to control more commune chief, at least at the same number as before. Before they control around 1,551 commune chiefs or communes. So this time maybe they will be able to control that because the number of the votes they increased at least almost 1%.
Let's talk about the way the election was conducted. Comfrel has said that 1.5 million people out of 9 million registered voters were not able to cast their votes. Why were they unable to vote?
We found out that the problem of the voter list. And this finding is come from we audit the voter list and at the end of the 2011, the interview, we got the data from the registered voter, and then we brought that the data, identity data, to verify with the official election result of the NEC of the National Electoral Commission. And we found out that the name, most registered name of people, does not in the official voter list. At least 17% of the registered voter, their name is something missed in the voter list. And we calculate it's around 1.5 million. So that those people will suffer during the election day. Some of them went to the polling station, but they're not able to find the name. So Comfrel continue to investigate the people not able to vote, and we will try to understand and try to find out what happened to them. They're not able to vote. So
overall, in overall terms, how would you describe the fairness of this election?
The turnout, you mean?
In terms of whether it was free and fair, the conduct of the election.
The conduct of election, if you look at only the election days during voting and counting, it has run smoothly and peacefully. But however, before the election days, especially during the election campaign or before election campaign, we found out that this is the big gap playing field between the ruling party and opposition. The ruling party have used a lot of state resource, property, and human resource involved in support carry out the ruling party activity or against other party. And the access to the media also very big gap between the opposition and ruling party. The ruling party able to access all the TV and many radios in that they cover in the rural, but opposition only able to access a few radio and have some print media that's not able to cover in many places in Cambodia, but just some part in the country. So yeah, that's the gap. And during the election campaign, we found out that the CPP have a huge resource to able to organize a very dynamic election campaign. And the ruling party and the opposition is no mean enough to compete with that election campaign of the ruling party CPP. Yeah.
Last month, India passed its first comprehensive law to tackle child sexual abuse. But the debate on the law has been sidetracked by a provision that lifts the age of consent from 16 to 18. Critics say the provision will criminalize sexual active adolescents, and supporters of the law are frustrated that it's being overshadowed by the side issue of sexual consent. Bill Bainbridge has more.
Once a taboo topic in India, child sexual abuse is now more out in the open in the media and the parliament, and there are widespread concerns that with rapid urbanisation and the continued marginalisation of some groups, sexual abuse may be a growing phenomena. But no one knows for sure, as Chief of UNICEF India's Child Protection Programme, Jose Begoa, explains.
The feeling that you can have is that this is a growing phenomenon, but we don't have any hard data to back that, to say, yes, child abuse is happening today more than 10 years ago. I cannot state that because I don't have the data to prove it.
It's been more than a decade in the making, a law to specifically address the problem of sexual abuse of minors, who were previously covered by elements of the penal code that didn't distinguish between children and adults. Both houses of parliament have now passed the Protection of Children from Sexual Offences Act, and it only awaits the president's signature to finally be passed into law. But it's still the subject of intense public debate. NGOs and UN agencies were extensively consulted during the drafting phase, where most experts were against raising the age of consent. But a last-minute change to the law inserted the provision. Anuradha Sathrabudai is the executive director of Nana Devi, an NGO based in Western India. She was one of those consulted.
That issue has been contentious and debatable even in the drafting committee, which I was a part of, because the reality, the ground reality is that the children are sexually active at an earlier age.
India's National Family Health Survey suggests 43% of women are sexually active before the age of 18. But in conservative India, sex outside of marriage is still frowned upon.
The culture we have in India, nobody likes extramarital relationships. So any sex outside the marital relationship is not an accepted form. So people who, children who are into consensus sex, the parents might use this law against them.
For UNICEF's Jose Begoa, the focus on the age of consent provision is a source of frustration.
The whole discourse, the whole discussion, the whole dialogue in the media, in the public opinion, has shifted towards that particular aspect of the law, the age of sexual consent of adolescents, when the law purpose was actually how to protect children from sexual offences, not how to criminalise children or adolescents for sexual relationships.
The law lays down strict punishments for up to life in prison for sexual offences against minors, has provision for setting up special courts for related offences, and speaks of child-friendly legal procedures. Most of its elements have won widespread praise from child advocates. But raising the age of consent has already been criticised by Delhi's High Court last month during an adjudication on a case where a young man was charged with kidnap and rape of his 17-year-old bride. The pair had been married with her consent, but against the will of her family. The court acquitted him, a result of little surprise to Jose Begoa.
There are many voices within India and in the judiciary, in government, etc., that are also questioning this. So whether this particular provision will have an actual effect and will be, you know, rigidly implemented or not, that has to be seen. But of course, there are quite a number of question marks around that.
And finally, some of Australia's leading businesses have helped fund a documentary exploring the plight of children in Papua New Guinea affected by HIV/AIDS. The film was launched Wednesday night in Melbourne at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image. The Australia-Pacific Business Coalition on AIDS hopes it'll help raise awareness and funds. The coalition says it's a model for how the corporate world can play a role in helping Australia's nearest neighbours. Joanna McCarthy has the story.
HIV/AIDS continues to exact a heavy toll across the Asia Pacific. One out of every five newly infected people comes from the region. In Papua New Guinea, more than 30,000 people are living with HIV, and they're not the only ones affected. The children left orphaned by parents with HIV/AIDS face a grim future. Stephen Grant is the CEO of the Asia Pacific Business Coalition on HIV and AIDS.
Well, what normally happens is they're ostracised from their societies and they don't have any financial support. And the real problem is that to get an education in Papua New Guinea, even in the public schools, it costs money. It costs a few hundred dollars a year. And the first thing that happens is these children's education stops. So they've got absolutely no opportunity to better themselves. Most of the children themselves aren't HIV positive, but one or more of their parents has died. And often they're living in an extended group with an uncle or a guardian who just hasn't got the time and the resources to ensure these children get an education.
It's something the coalition is trying to address. It's raising money from corporate Australia and individuals to help pay the children's school fees, uniforms, books and other costs of education. And it hopes that a documentary about its work in PNG will encourage corporate donors to dig deeper and help fund its efforts in rolling out the program in Thailand and Cambodia. It's a new phase in the coalition's work, which has long been running education programs in the workforce.
We're in 11 countries now, and we educate the workforce on how not to get HIV and AIDS. But in Papua New Guinea, we've gone a stage further because of this problem that's emerged. And we're now seeing this problem in other countries in Asia, like Thailand, Cambodia, and we're starting the exercise there.
The coalition was formed in 2006 when then Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer and AusAid approached some of the country's leading business people to see if they could play a role in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
Tell the story quickly. I mean, as you'll know, AIDS has been a huge problem in Africa for a long time. And the fight against HIV and AIDS in Africa was led by governments, but businesses played a really key role. The corporate sector weren't playing a major role in the Asia Pacific, and this was an opportunity for them to do so.
And with that report from Joanna McCarthy, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple, pcj@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well, hoping we'll see you all again very soon. Bye-bye, everyone.